InnovaBuzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 84 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses with an interest in innovation become even more innovative. In this episode, my guest is Alan Dibb, the founder of SuccessWise and a serial entrepreneur, self-described rebellious marketer and technology freak. SuccessWise is a business that helps other businesses grow fast. They do that by helping to implement a highly effective marketing system. The framework upon which that marketing system is based is the subject of Alan's book, The One-Page Marketing Plan, which we explore in some detail during this interview. Those of you who have been following my podcast for a while will know that I'm a big fan of frameworks and structure that make what might appear complex things on the surface become easy to implement. The One-Page Marketing Plan certainly fits that mold. Without further ado, then let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Alan Dibb. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to have with me today on this episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast, all the way from Melbourne in Australia, over on the Mornington Peninsula, I believe, Alan Dibb, who's the founder of SuccessWise, and he describes himself as a serial entrepreneur, a rebellious marketer, and a technology freak. So I'm keen to find out more about all of those. So welcome to the podcast today.
Hey, Jürgen, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Now, SuccessWise is a business that helps other businesses grow fast. They do that by helping to implement highly effective marketing systems. Alan is also the author of the book, The One-Page Marketing Plan, which outlines a straightforward framework for marketing. So I really like that book, and I'm keen to learn more and chat with Alan today.
Awesome.
Now, before we get on to all kinds of things, leadership and entrepreneurship and innovation, let's find out a little bit more about your journey. Alan, when you were a young boy, what did you want to be?
I think I've always been a bit of a techno geek. So I used to be into electronics as a kid, and I think I saw myself growing up to be a scientist, but that never occurred. So I went into IT and built and grew my first business. It was I was a dead broke IT geek for a long time until I learned the ins and outs of marketing. You know, I thought at the time that just being good at IT meant that I would make a lot of money, but that was very much not the case, especially running my own business. So I really had to learn the hard and expensive way how to get good at marketing, and it was a journey that took about 10 years, but I finally cracked the code as such, and I grew that to be a national business. I exited that probably about 10 years ago now. So so that's taken me on a journey to build multiple very high growth businesses, one of them which was one of Australia's fastest growing companies, and I exited that as well. So I've basically built, grown, and exited businesses. So that's been my journey, and now I'm helping other businesses do the same.
Yeah, that's an interesting journey, and it's most of the businesses that you talk about are technology businesses, right? I think there was a telecommunications one that you're still involved in.
Yeah, so they've been mostly technology focused, but I think that the principles just apply to any business. I mean, I work a lot into tech because that's what I'm interested in, but they apply equally well to carpet cleaners, private jet sales, all sorts of things. So the cool thing is the principles rarely change.
Yeah, the marketing principles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We'll come to that in a little moment. So I'm interested that, you know, you made a comment that you thought you went into the IT world and you thought, because, I mean, a lot of people feel intimidated by IT, so there's obviously a need there for people who understand it to help those that are intimidated by it out. But it's not enough to just get out there and say, I know how to do this. You've actually got to market it, right? So when did that kind of dawn on you?
Well, it was actually a very specific moment. I was working with a coach, and he's someone who's been a mentor to me for a long time. And one thing that he said to me, he goes, when does someone find out that you deliver a really good product or service? And I said, you know, well, after we've after we've worked together. And and then he goes, well, you know, until they find that out, I mean, you need to have really, really good marketing, because you know, what we're talking, a lot of people think being really good at what they do, that's the critical thing, but really people don't find that out until you've sold them your service. So before that, you've got to get good at marketing and selling your service. So that was the moment it really, the penny really dropped for me, and I understood I needed to become a really good marketer, not just a really, really good technician.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of, and you said earlier about applying to all businesses, and I think that belief that if you're good at what you do, then people will come and use your services or your product is kind of across all businesses as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's a real myth that a lot of people they spend years and years of frustration with, because they know they're really good at what they do. They know they've got a really good product or service. So why isn't my bank account reflecting how good I am? And that's a very, very common frustration. So, and it's just, it really is simply because they haven't understood that they're in the business of marketing themselves. They're not in the business of, you know, doing haircuts or doing IT or doing law or whatever. If you're a business owner, you're in the business of marketing that particular service. You're not in the business necessarily of being technical in that. I mean, you may have to be technical in order to deliver those products or services, but you really need to understand first and foremost, you are a marketing organization. So you need to start getting good at the marketing of what you do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it's important to remember for every business. So why do you do what you do?
Look, I just love working with a variety of businesses. I work with businesses in finance, in law, in all sorts of industries, in technology and telecommunications. And I just love working with a spectrum of clients and understanding the unique challenges in each industry. It's funny though, as unique as people think that their industry is, they pretty much face a lot of the same hurdles. You know, they face marketing hurdles, they face hurdles in terms of competition and internet disruption. So it's interesting. I mean, of course, there are variations across industries, but very much it's interesting to see how much stays the same across different industries rather than how much is different.
Mm, yeah, and my business coach often says to me, focus on the things that are the same, because you can often learn from other people or help other people by going there rather than figuring out why your situation is unique and different.
Absolutely, that's good advice.
Mm. So let's explore the one-page marketing plan a little bit more then. I'd want to begin with, because I hadn't come across this before, so I knew about the 80-20 rule. And, you know, basically 20% of your effort delivers 80% of your results, and that can be applied to all kinds of things in life. But you've taken that another level, right? You've said the 64-4 rule, which essentially breaks that down even tighter.
Yeah. Look, I mean, this was something that, again, in the research for the one-page marketing plan, that I was just blown away with. I mean, we know, to give the listeners a bit of background, I'm sure everyone's heard of the 80-20 rule. It's sometimes called the Pareto principle. It's where essentially you say 80% of your result comes from 20% of your effort. And it's funny that just applies across almost everything. You know, it's like 80% of your crop will come from 20% of your seeds, and 80% of your income will come from 20% of your clients, and so on and so forth. And it just applies almost across everything. And it was discovered by an Italian economist when he was looking at wealth distribution. And it's funny that was his discovery of this 80-20 rule was about 100 years ago. And he was looking at the wealth distribution in Italy, and he was saying that, you know, 80% of the wealth was held by about 20% of the people. And you'd think, okay, 100 years ago, there was not much information. So, you know, the wealthy maybe had a concentration of information and therefore they had 80% of the wealth. But it's interesting, that same stat applies even now. So right now, 80% of the wealth is held by 20% of the people. And it's funny, we've all got almost the exact same information. So we've all got access to the internet, we've all got access to smartphones. So the wealthy don't get any better information than the people who are poor. So it's interesting. It's so that 80-20 rule really is a psychological thing. It's not necessarily something where the wealthier are hoarding a bunch of information that the poor don't have access to. So that was an interesting thing to me in the research. So that the rule holds still when there's so much information out there, when there's so much understanding and knowledge, and it's been democratized to a large extent. So and then I kept researching it further, and I saw that, you know, that you can apply the 80-20 rule to itself. So you take 80% of 80 and you get 64. And you do the same to the 20%, and anyway you come to the 64-4 rule, and so that basically says that 64% of the wealth is held by 4% of the people, and again 64% of your results come about from 4% of your efforts. So I thought that was really, really interesting. So a very small percentage of your own results come from a very small amount of your efforts. So basically, put another way, 96% of the stuff you do, relatively speaking, is a waste of time.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So, so that's where, you know, honing in on that 4% and expanding that's where you can have massive leverage.
Hmm. So, what's your approach to looking at that? Because I looked at those numbers and I thought, well, I could probably sit down and try to figure it out, but I'd probably get confused very quickly. So what do you have a systematic approach for figuring out, you know, what is that 4% or even what is that 20%?
Sure. So look, to me, there's many areas in a business that you can look at and you can improve. So, you know, you can look at, okay, how do we deliver a product or service? Can we improve that? Can we improve the training of our people? Can we improve our negotiation skills with our suppliers? And all of those things are good, but like they give you incremental improvement in your business. So if you get a little bit better at negotiating and your costs come down a little bit, it gives you an incremental improvement. And if you get, you know, a little bit better at or quicker at delivering your product, again, that gives you an incremental improvement. That's not something I would put in that 4%. But by and large, I've seen the inside of many, many businesses, and the thing that really moves the needle most is understanding and creating a marketing system in the business. So that's something that can have exponential difference. Sorry, that was my phone ring. That's something that can have really exponential increases in your business success. So it moves the needle massively more than something that creates an incremental improvement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I like the way you segmented that, segued there into the marketing system and marketing plan. So I'd actually like to get you to run us through the one-page marketing plan in a little bit of detail. So as I was saying before we started the podcast, I'm a great fan of frameworks and systems that make things easier. And I think the one-page marketing plan that you've laid out in your book is a wonderful framework that I think will help most businesses actually understand and implement a good marketing plan.
Sure. So look, basically the one-page marketing plan, it came about from when I was working with clients and I would encourage them to create a marketing plan because I found that to be an extremely valuable process. And this is where they often get stuck. You know, it feels very intimidating. It feels like a big intimidating thing to do. There's graphs and charts and all of that, and to a large extent they were absolutely right. So I went back to solve this problem, and I wanted to come up with a process where you could map out the whole plan to market your business on a single page. And so I put a lot of work into this, and I broke it down into the critical factors that make up a marketing plan, and I broke that into the 9 different stages. It's nine different steps in the marketing process, and they're separated by three major stages. I call them acts: Act One, Act Two, Act Three. So there's the before, the during, and the after. And so basically, by filling in the framework, which is the one-page marketing plan, you can walk away with a very comprehensive direct response marketing plan for your business in a very short amount of time. In, you know, maybe under half an hour, you can fill that in, and you've got a very comprehensive, solid plan for your business. It's something that you would have well thought out, and it covers all of the major parts of the direct response marketing process.
So, and I like the way it's broken down into basically before, during, and after. So before, people know about you. So the major objective there is get people to find out about you and, you know, find out about your product or service before you deliver it, obviously. And then there's the conversion process, which is where they know about you, but they are comparing various options perhaps, and they've or maybe they get distracted by other stuff. So there's got to be a way to keep in touch with them and then ultimately convert them into customers. And then I like the fact that you've also got that third level, which is when they are customers, delivering on the promise, looking at the lifetime value of the customers to see, you know, how else can you help them, because there's going to be opportunities there, and it's a lot easier to sell to people you've got a relationship with and that are already customers. And then the referral process, which kind of loops you back to generating new business again.
And this after phase, this after you've dealt with a customer, that is the place where I see so much money left on the table, because so many times people think that after the transaction is finished, that's it. You know, you've delivered your product or service, and that's it. Move on to new customers. But there's just gold in so many businesses in their past client base, and re-engaging with those and increasing frequency and increasing the amount that's sold to them. So, yeah, there's massive untapped potential in that phase.
So in the book, you basically say that, you know, whilst this is a pretty simple framework, or pretty simple in my words, but it is the way to build quite a sophisticated marketing plan that essentially gets you from nothing to having a really good plan and delivering on that plan.
Yeah, the whole idea of the book was so that when the reader finished the book, they were able to, or not even when they finished, while they're reading the book, they're able to fill in the one-page marketing plan template. And when they're done, that's it. They've got a solid, comprehensive marketing plan for their business. And it's one that they can, you know, being literally one page, rather than shoving it in the drawer and forgetting about it, it's something that you can literally pin up in your office or above your desk or whatever, and just keep in mind. And it can be a living document that can be updated. So that was a very important factor to me in creating this. I wanted it to be something useful and practical on a day-to-day basis when a business owner is thinking about marketing and doing the executing on their marketing strategy.
And it's really good in that sense. I mean, I love those things that are actually living documents that are useful and can drive the strategy and the tactics within a business, because coming from the corporate world, you know, I don't know how many comprehensive documents, you know, 100-page documents of strategic blueprints or marketing plans or strategic plans I've put together. And it's exactly as you say, they usually, once they're done, they put in a drawer, and a year later when it's time to kind of revisit it, you pull it out of the drawer and say, now what did that say again?
Exactly. Yeah.
So this is quite different, because it really gets to the nitty-gritty of driving it. So do you want to step us through the nine steps?
Sure. So the nine steps of the one-page marketing plan, there's a chapter that covers each of them, but I'll essentially quickly run through them. So the first step is selecting your target market. Very, very important, because a lot of people, when you talk to them, they'll say, "Oh, my target market's everyone. You know, everyone needs web design, or everyone needs chiropractic care, and all of that." And that's okay. But that becomes a very, very difficult, expensive exercise when it comes to marketing, because you have to go too broad, you have to use mass media, and most small businesses just can't afford and can't do it. And it's a very wasteful way to advertise. So what I recommend is choosing a very select target market. Now, people worry about limiting the people that they sell to, and this is what I say. I say you don't have to limit who you'll do work for, but in your advertising campaign, you do need to be targeted. So, if for example, mums over 40 is your target market, you have a very specific message for them. That's very different to say, young men who are in their 20s, that they'll respond to a very, very different message than that target market. So it's, and you can run multiple campaigns side by side, but what I often recommend is select one target market, dominate it, and then move on to the next. And that doesn't mean if work comes your way that's outside of your target market, you can't take it. But what we're talking in your marketing system, you're targeting one particular target market with a very specific message. And that brings us to the second part of the framework, which is crafting your message. So what we want is for the message to be very, very highly relevant to our target market. We want the whole goal of this phase is for the person who's reading or listening to your message to essentially say, hey, that's for me, because the brain receives so many different marketing messages each day that it just ignores everything that, unless it's very specific and very specific to them. So if you're a 40-year-old plumber and there's a message that's targeted to a 40-year-old plumber, you'll pay attention. Whereas if it's just targeted very generally to everyone, then it's likely you're going to miss out on that message. So
that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I really like that. I mean, I'm doing some work with Seth Godin through one of his mastermind programs at the moment, and his take on that is very much, focus on a niche, but he says, break it down to the very smallest niche that you can live with, and then obsess over them and delight them.
I love it.
Yeah. And as you say, then you can target that message very clearly. Now, if somebody comes to you and says, well, I need that service too, who's outside that target audience, you can still choose to work with them. That's not to say that you're not turning away people.
Yeah, most definitely. And the way I sort of illustrate it to people is, if you've broken your knee, would you prefer just to go to a general doctor? Yeah. Would you like to see a knee specialist? So you want someone to basically say, hey, that's for me. I've got a broken knee. I need to see the knee specialist. So rather than the doctor listing, okay, we do heart surgery, we do lungs, we do brain surgery, we do knees, you're going to lose the effectiveness of the message by doing that. Okay. The third part of the one-page marketing plan is advertising media. So we want to choose what media we're going to reach our target audience with and what media we're going to get our message through. So there's online media, there's offline media, and basically that's some of the decision work that we need to make.
And that would include things like what networks to find your ideal clients, where are they likely to hang out, if it's in a physical sense, or where are they going to be online with social media, for example. So some people might prefer LinkedIn to Facebook, others vice versa.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I like people to think of media very, very carefully, because there's a lot of hype and a lot of nonsense about social media, and a lot of people make it out to be just a cure-all and make it seem like the principles of marketing no longer apply. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, social media is awesome, you've got to understand that it is just the media. So it's not something that's completely overtaken all the principles of marketing. So again, even as you correctly mentioned, you know, there's going to be a different target audience who's on LinkedIn. There's going to be a different target audience who's on Twitter or Facebook. And even within those social networks, there's going to be segmentation as well. There's going to be people who are on Facebook for, you know, a particular purpose. Some people are there just to hang out with friends. Some people are there, you know, five times a day. Some are there three times a year. So so you're going to be able to segment very, very carefully and choose where does your target audience hang out. And sometimes your target market, you know, may not be where you think it is. So, I mean, a lot of people have discounted things like direct mail and some of these offline media, but a lot of them just produce enormous return on investment, especially in business-to-business kind of marketing that works very, very well with offline media.
Yeah, that's right. I was just going to ask you about that because I know you mentioned in the book direct marketing and the more traditional means using snail mail, if you like, and brochures or whatever it might be, but in a way that, you know, because I think so few people do that these days that it's pretty easy to actually be innovative in that space.
It is. It is very, very much. And, you know, it's funny, like with all the advertising that's gone on online, and let me be clear, I'm not against online advertising. Mm. I think it's awesome. And there's a lot of things that you can do that you can't do offline. But one really cool thing is that it's become a lot less uncluttered to deliver things via traditional mail and direct mail, and now online's become more cluttered, whereas it used to be the other way around. So it can get you a lot of cut through, and it can get you really good return on investment.
Hmm. All right. So, and I like to say also at this stage already, you know, where you're delivering that message that it's the start of a relationship journey. So it's kind of like the hero's journey where, you know, you're issuing a challenge essentially to your ideal audience to say, you know, come and take a look at what I've got to offer you and see whether it's useful for you. And the journey, and so it's not a once-off, you know, read my ad and buy my product. It's a journey, and it's building a relationship. So I like to say that, you know, from this point on, you really need to be delivering exceptional value to stand out from the crowd.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's 100% right. So it's all about, I mean, if you're in it for just a quick transaction or whatever, then this is probably not for you. But this is all about building relationships and building a tribe of raving fans. And that takes a strategy, and that takes a plan to do that.
Mm. All right. And the second phase then is the lead nurturing and sales conversion phase, right? That's when
so then we move into the, so what we described now, those three steps, that was part of the before phase. In the during phase, that's when someone's indicated some interest. So maybe they've called you, maybe they've responded to your a contact form on your website, all of that sort of stuff. So that's when they enter the during phase of the marketing process. And we split that up into three areas as well. So the first area is capturing those leads. And a lot of people don't have a system for lead capture, which is amazing to me, given the low cost and high functionality of the technology that's out there. So very often, simply implementing a good CRM system where you can now capture leads and follow up with them either automatically or manually, hopefully a combination of both. And then that leads into the next step, which is nurturing those leads. So we want to build trust, we want to build a reputation, and we want to give them some results in advance. So we want to give them more than just, hey, give us a call, we're here to help, or free quotes or something like that. So nurturing them through the buying cycle. So there's almost no scenario where you don't want a prospect to be well informed. So dealing with well informed prospects and then sifting and sorting through them, that's part of your nurturing process. And then that naturally leads into the last step of the during phase, which is sales conversion. That's when they finally decide, okay, I want to become a client, and there's a there's a transfer of value. So you deliver your service and they give you money. So that's basically the during phase of the marketing process.
Hmm. And this is the area we get involved in quite a lot. And like you say, I'm always amazed how often I find people that are not capturing leads at all. And a lot of people that do capture leads, or they kind of think they capture leads, but they've got, you know, subscribe to our blog or subscribe to our newsletter as their offer, and they wonder why they don't get a lot of people signing up. And it's very much like you say about delivering some value here.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at most advertising or even online, offline, whatever, you'll see you can pretty much swap out the name of the business and the logo and the phone number, and it could be any business in that industry. So it's usually, you know, a laundry list of products and services that they do, you know, give us a call and that's about it, and their logo. It's basically name, rank, and serial number. There's really nothing unique there being offered or thought about, or a target market that has a compelling message to them. So
it does come back there to the target market, doesn't it? Because if you have a really clear understanding of who that target market is, who that ideal client is, what their needs are, what their wants and aspirations, what their frustrations and fears are, then that already positions you right now to say, well, what can I give them that's going to help address some of that stuff, and that's going to make them sit up and say, whoa, this is really useful. I better sign up for that and download that.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm. All right. And tell us a little bit more about the sales conversion one, because I think it's interesting. When I was reading through the book, I thought, you know, that there was a lot of interesting ideas there that were very specific. And one of the things that became clear to me as I was reading through the earlier part was that, you know, when you get to that sales conversion thing, you've probably done most of the work.
Absolutely. Look, a lot of people think of sales conversion as, you know, I've got to do a close and all of this sort of stuff, and I've got to convince and all of that. But realistically, by the time you've got to sales conversion, it should just be a natural fit or not a fit, right? It should be, you know, there should be really no convincing or closing or any of these silly sort of close techniques. You know, would you like it first thing tomorrow or tomorrow or this afternoon, or would you like it in, you know, all of these ridiculous sales tactics and pressure tactics. It really should become a natural progression of the process. It should be like, you know, that you've taken the client through a nurturing process, and it should be really just a matter of both of you sitting down and say, okay, what's the next step? Let's get started.
But you do talk about having a powerful guarantee in place, about, you know, making sure that there's the risk is pretty well on the seller, and that, you know, you focused on the promise you're making in the original message. So is it delivering that promise, and how's it contributing to the customer's business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing is about, and this is pretty much the whole of a sales process. It's making a promise and delivering on that promise. And again, as I said, I mean, if you're just in it for a quick transaction and just to get out, then again, this probably is not for you. But this is for someone who's wanting to build a client for life, develop relationships, and, you know, have someone who's a raving fan. So I mean, when you're dealing with someone, you want them to take all the risk, that's when the sales process becomes difficult. And that's when you need to do compelling and convincing, and you've got to do all these silly close techniques. But if there's no risk at all from someone dealing with you, then that just smooths things out so easily. I mean, and you can remove risk in multiple ways. You know, you can do risk reversal, you can do guarantees, and there's you know, these things just make the sales process easy, and they make it natural. You know, so often the sales process is awkward, and there's pressure on both sides, and that negotiation and all of that, and that can be easily eliminated by just having the right guarantees in place and having a bit of risk reversal, and just approaching it from a client's point of view, thinking from the client, you know, why wouldn't they do business with me? You know, and you've just got to make it a no-brainer. It's got to be, you've got to make it so it's just ridiculous that they wouldn't do business with you.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. And you do have some interesting examples in the book there, which I really like. You know, that, I mean, there's a whole range of ideas that you can come up with there, basically from a guarantee to essentially delivering return on investment is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's just making it to be an obvious thing to deal with you. So it's just making it about moving to the next level and, you know, naturally moving to the next part of the relationship, which might be working together. And sometimes, I mean, you've just got to be open and honest and say, you know what, this is just not a good fit. And you know, what you want and what I deliver are not quite aligned. And that can be for any number of reasons. It could be, you know, they're not in your target market, or it could be that your product is not appropriate for, not going to deliver a solution for what they need. And again, in that case, you just part on good terms and maybe there might be a fit down the track.
That's right. And that's a really good one to build trust, actually. I mean, I think the whole approach so far with the steps is actually filtering out the people that aren't a good fit. But, you know, at this stage, if somebody gets through to this stage and you feel that as though on either side that there's not a good fit, then you, as you say, you part company on good terms. And I've even told people, hey, they'd be better off dealing with a competitor because I think that's a better fit for you. So, you know, that maintains that level of trust that often results in those people, even if they don't do business with you and they're not a good fit for you, they may refer somebody to you later on where they, because at this stage they probably understand who's a good client for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, that level of trust I think is really important.
Most definitely. So often people take on bad business. You know, it's bad for them. They don't make a lot of money. It's a cheap client or whatever, and the client's not happy either because they've got particular expectations that are not being delivered on. So some of this sifting and sorting process is very, very important.
Mm, that's a really good point. I mean, I've got to put my hand up and say, you know, I've had clients like that. And this morning I was actually on a webinar where we were talking about what do you do when, you know, clients turn bad on you was the expression. And I think, you know, this process here is likely to minimize that happening. And particularly if you then follow the next three steps, which that was a thing for me about the One-Page Marketing Plan book that I thought, wow, this just puts it all in a much bigger picture and makes it all make so much sense, because usually a marketing strategy in the traditional sense is finished at this stage. You've made the sale and that's the end of marketing. Now you hand it off to the, I don't know, the production department or the operations department who deliver the product or service. But you say, okay, there's another three steps to the marketing plan.
Oh, most definitely. So, you know, a lot of people will give sort of cursory attention to the after phase, but in my opinion, it's the most critical phase, and it's the phase where all the money really is. In my opinion, the after phase is really where the money is actually made. So the after phase is basically broken down into three steps again. So the first step of the after phase is delivering a world-class experience. So making sure that you're just really delivering on what the client expects, but going above that. So really over-delivering. And I know there's a lot of lip service paid to under-promising and over-delivering, but there are ways that are not very costly and not very hard to do that just wow clients. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as a handwritten thank you note, you know, thank you for doing business with us. And it just, you know, these small unexpected things, they're so rare that people just get blown away by them. So so having a think of your whole business, every touch point in your business that a customer deals with. So how did the delivery of their product go? How did the packaging of their product go or service? All of those things, how did they, how did the payment process go and all of this sort of thing. So just delivering a really smooth, world-class experience. And, you know, again, you can use technology to help you deliver a really, really good experience. And then there's CRMs in place that can remind you to do something or that can follow up with a client or you know, ticketing systems that work really well with all of that sort of thing, making sure that a customer is fully satisfied. So there's a lot of ways to do it. There's no reason not to do it. It's not difficult and it's not expensive, and it makes a huge, huge difference.
Hmm. Yeah, I really like that with the ideas. I was talking maybe back 3 or 4 months ago with Alistair McGill on the podcast, and he's calls himself a customer experience designer. And one of the things he said kind of struck me, and that was, and I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it could be 80%, you know, 80-20 rule. 80% of people expect to be disappointed when they have an experience with, you know, somebody that they're a customer of. So it was some huge number. And his point was, you know, if you start off by just delivering on what you promise, you're already standing out from the crowd and you're way above what people expect.
Yeah, so. Most definitely. I mean, just, you know, it's very, very small things that make a very, very big difference. There's not, you know, if you had to massively change everything, and some people do. I mean, some people have just a terrible customer experience. So in those cases, they do. But for the most part, most people, the customer experience they deliver is just okay. It's you know, mediocre, it's passable, you know, the customer gets their stuff and you get your payment. But to transition to an experience where the customer is delighted, it's actually not that hard to do. There's only a few usually tweaks and changes and just sort of going a little bit against what your industry offers and can make a huge difference.
Hmm. Yeah, which leads on to, I guess, the next two parts of the marketing plan, right? Because if you've really delighted your customer, given them the product or the service that solves their immediate need, but in a way that you've actually wowed them beyond their expectation, then you've set yourself up to actually deliver more to them and to get them become raving fans and deliver referrals.
Yeah, most definitely. So the next part of the afterpays is increasing customer lifetime value. And this is where really a lot of people leave so much money on the table. It's, you know, they it's kind of the would you like fries with that? If we were to compare it to say a McDonald's, I mean, would you like fries to that? With that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars to McDonald's, and it's a very easy thing. And I mean, in that case, it's an add-on. But there's many different ways to increase customer lifetime value. For example, you can increase how often people buy from you, or you can take them through an ascension where they might be on a particular type of product or service, but there's a better version or a better service or a higher level that you can take them to that will give them an even better experience. So there's ascension, there's upselling where you might introduce a complimentary product to them. So and another place that people don't even think about is raising their prices. Very often people will price their service too low, and very often raising prices is a very easy way of increasing customer lifetime value. And a lot of people freak out that, you know, customers will just go away. But if you're delivering that world-class experience, and if you're delivering that really, really good VIP kind of experience where customers are just wowed, if you're above above the industry average, that's not going to make your clients go away. Very unlikely anyway.
Yeah, not unless you're outrageous about your pricing.
Yeah, true.
Mm. I mean, I'd come back to what I've kind of, you know, I've made a lot of notes on reading through the book, and in each box I've put deliver exceptional value always. So that, for me, that's kind of my mantra, is, you know, always deliver exceptional value. And that starts with, you know, the defining the ideal client and starting to communicate with them. So I'm already in that mindset of, I've got to deliver them exceptional value, something that'll make them sit up and listen for, and you know, capture their attention, because we've got so much that is competing for our attention these days. So I've delivered the exceptional value, and I keep driving through that, and I say, okay, if I'm delivering exceptional value, then, you know, my pricing, whatever it is, it's got to match that.
I love it. That's absolutely a great principle to have throughout your business.
Now, the other one I wanted to throw in there and see what you thought, because I'm not sure you've addressed this in the book, but I was talking to someone during the Business Systems Summit recently that I was involved as a co-host and presenter on, and this was Pauline Martin Brooks, who works with people on developing partnerships, and she actually had a process that reminded me very much of your one-page marketing plan to develop partners. So, you know, who's your ideal partner, and how do you get their attention and so on, and how do you nurture them, and how do you then develop that partnership? And I thought, well, partnerships is another big thing here on increasing the lifetime value of customers, because if my specialty, for example, is digital marketing, but I've got a client that I've been working with a long time on that, and I see they have a need in, let's say, I don't know, design work, or maybe it's in writing systems and processes, or maybe it's in the HR area. If I've got partnerships with people that are specialists in those areas, then I can kind of add value to them beyond what's in my own company.
Yeah, most definitely. And that naturally leads into the last stage of the marketing process, and the last stage of the after phase, which is orchestrating and stimulating referrals. And I think the operative word there is orchestrating, because a lot of people sit back and wait and hope that referrals come their way. You know, hope is their referral strategy. Whereas, whereas you can actually have a system for, like any other part of your marketing process, you can have a system that actually helps you with referrals and stimulating those referrals. So a lot of people just hope and wait for word of mouth, and that's a very, very hard and long-term strategy to sort of sit and hope for. So it's all about orchestrating and stimulating those referrals.
That's right. And that's where you do talk a little bit about joint ventures in there, right? It's sort of going out and cross referrals and so on.
Absolutely. So, I mean, joint ventures are fantastic. You know, dealing with someone who's in a complementary business but not necessarily competitive to you, that can be a really, really good way of you know, having a win-win kind of scenario. So, you know, if I sell web hosting and you do web development services, I mean, that's a great fit. You know, we can send business, you know, one way or another. And you know, it's funny, a lot of people say, you know, well, how should I orchestrate and stimulate referrals? And, you know, like many things in life, it's one of those things where one of the best ways to get it is just to ask for it. Very few people actually ask for referrals. You know, they feel like, you know, they're begging for business or whatever, but there are ways to position it in a way that, you know, that people want to refer people to you. Because if you think about the way that the reason and the way that most people refer, they actually do it for themselves. They don't do it for you. I mean, think of the last time that you recommended a movie or a restaurant to a friend. It wasn't because you wanted to do a favor to the movie theater chain or the restaurant. It was because you wanted to do your friend a favor. You wanted them to have a really good experience. So, so basically positioning it in a way that makes the referrer look and feel good, makes it makes it a system that's really, really easy to deploy and can start stimulating and orchestrating those referrals.
Mm. That's right. And I like what you said, just ask. A lot of people don't ask, which is, I think, a problem across the board everywhere. I often say, well, what's the worst thing that can happen to you if you don't ask? The answer is always going to be no. So if the answer is no here, I guess then you've got to be asking yourself, well, why wouldn't they refer me to somebody else?
Most definitely.
Hmm. And the other thing is, if you've got a really good customer who you're absolutely wowing, it's in their interest that your business is healthy and is going to be there for the long term, because they want you there for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's 100% right. And I mean, you can make it, you can do it in ways that make the referrer feel like an insider, and like that they you know, they've got their business. You know, you can give someone a $100 voucher or whatever value it is, but let's call it a $100 voucher to your services. So when someone gives that to a friend, I mean, they're giving them quite a bit of value. They're not just, you know, saying, hey, go see this guy. They're saying, you know, oh, okay, you need web development services. You know, I know Joe blogs. He does a really good job. And in fact, he's $100 to your next project.
Yeah. So there's definitely some innovative ways to orchestrate referrals, as you say, and encourage people to do that. And there's a couple of good examples in the book as well. So that's been really good, Alan. As I said to you earlier before we started the interview, I really love the book and I love the way it's laid out. And I'm a huge fan of frameworks that make things easy to understand, and particularly what you said a few moments ago about having the plan that is dynamic and actionable. I think there's huge value in that. So congratulations on that book. It's awesome. And I'd encourage everybody to go and have a look at that. You can get it on Amazon. We'll link to it in the show notes. And also if you visit the number1pmp.com, there's a website there where you can access the book as well and some resources to go with it.
Right.
Well, I'd like to move on to our innovation round, the buzz, which is the time when we ask our guests to help our audience, who are primarily innovators in their field and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that's going to inspire our audience today and help them do something awesome.
I'll do my very best for you.
Yeah. So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Look, in my experience, innovation really needs very quiet focus, large blocks of focus time. You know, so there's so many distractions these days. You've got your cell phone, your email pinging every minute, all of that sort of stuff. And that's not an environment that's really super conducive to focus and to innovation. So very often, if I've got to crack a big problem, I will just lock myself in a room, turn everything off, and then, you know, come back an hour or two later and return all the messages, apologize to all the people who, you know, who are trying to reach me or whatever, all of that sort of stuff. I think that's so important, and it's a massive challenge these days with the way technology sort of encroached upon us.
Mm. Yeah, that's great advice. And recently a group of us ran a planning retreat in Thailand where we actually got together and did some business planning for a bunch of businesses away from the day-to-day grind. So we were in a tropical island location. The internet was actually really bad, so we didn't have a lot of distraction there, and we were away from the day-to-day grind of business. And to be able to focus in that environment and the transformations that people actually achieved in their planning was quite astounding. So yeah, I can really appreciate what you're saying there.
I love it.
All right, so what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Look, I really like the advice of the great American philosopher Michael Jordan, just do it. You know, so very often we'll plan and we'll procrastinate and we'll sit there and try and make a bigger deal of what something is. And really, sometimes it's just a matter of getting in there, ready, fire, aim, and just get it done, you know. So, and that was very much my approach with the book. I mean, I could have spent years trying to write a book, but I essentially locked myself away for a month and a bit and just got it done, you know, because otherwise I would have been sitting there procrastinating. So, you know, I worked like a madman. I worked crazy hours and, you know, ignored everybody. But that was my process. And I think that's been the way that I've done a lot of big, big, difficult projects. So,
That's great advice. We all have a tendency, I think, to overthink things at times, or maybe a lot of times. I think I've used that word a few times recently when I was talking to people. I don't overthink it. Do what you think is right. All right. What's your favorite tool or system for improving your own productivity and allowing you to kind of do things like write the book or be more innovative in other areas?
Sure. Look, for me, it comes down to the to-do list. And I know there's a lot of mass loads of tools and things like that, to-do list tools and everything like that. But literally, I just use a notepad, a digital notepad. So I use Notes on Apple, and I have a to-do list at the start of the day, and I know what I've got to get through. The other thing, I use a system. So I love David Allen's GTD, or Getting Things Done. So I follow that, maybe not exactly, but loosely. So so I think that's a really, really good framework for productivity. So that's probably the number one thing that I use for improving productivity.
Yeah, great advice. And I've had a few recent guests actually say, you know, they say this might sound dorky. I think somebody said to me recently, this might sound dorky, but a list, that's my favorite tool. And I say, well, not at all. Because I think, and I love the David Allen philosophy. I mean, I've been using that for a long time in kind of a loose way, a bit of a framework, but the philosophy of getting stuff onto your list and getting it out of your head so that you can focus, which is what you were saying earlier, focus on what's at hand. And then at the same time, not forget things. So, and then, you know, actually, if you could combine that list into something that it self sorts itself into that 64-4 category, that would be even better.
Absolutely.
All right. So what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
Look, I like to split things up into 90-day chunks. So normally, you know, we sort of overestimate what we'll get done in a week or in a month, but 90 days is a really good period where you can say, I need to get these three big projects done, or this is the focus of my next 90 days. So I think that's a really good way of keeping things on track, and I work with clients that way as well. So when we work together, we put together a 90-day plan, and then every 90 days we reassess, you know, how did we go, and first of all, and then what are we going to do in the next 90 days? So that's one way I like to operate.
That's great. It's very similar to the planning framework that we put in place at this event that I was mentioning. That so we breaking down the next 12 months into seasons, which essentially are 90-day chunks.
Perfect.
And then what's the focus for each of those?
That's excellent.
All right. So what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, look, the number one thing I think anyone can do is learn and become a good marketer. Like if you're a plumber or a hairdresser or a lawyer or a doctor, just understand that marketing will touch every part of your business and your income, and it will make a massive difference in your business. So I think that's the number one thing that you can do that will move the needle the most and make a difference for you.
That's great advice. And I think, when we started the interview, you mentioned how essentially every business was in the business of marketing their own business.
Absolutely.
All right. So what's the future for Alan Dibb then, and for the SuccessWise business?
Yeah. Look. I'm looking to release another book in the next, hopefully in the next 6 months or so. So that's currently a project I've got. I'm looking also to deliver a membership service as well. A lot of people who've read my book maybe are in a startup phase, or they're a smaller business, and you know there's not an ability there to work one-on-one, but they still want to get advice and work together. So I'm looking at possibly a membership program for those people. I love working with startups, and I love working with new businesses and people who've got new ideas, but often sometimes just, you know, the ability to have the funds to work on with one-on-one coaching is not there. So there are a couple of projects I've got in the pipeline. I've also got a podcast that I'm looking to come out with shortly as well. So lots on.
Mm. Yeah, well, look forward to all of that. So what's the book going to be about?
I probably can't release too much detail, okay, but it's going to be essentially a follow-on to the one-page marketing plan. So, I'm still talking to publishers and working out a few bits and pieces, but essentially a follow-up to the one-page marketing. Call it a sequel.
Sequel, okay. All right, well, we'll keep our eyes out for that in the next 6 to 12 months, and also the podcast, which may be sooner, I guess. And the other things like the membership website that you mentioned.
Yeah, so just feel free to keep in touch with me. My website is successwise.com, and I'd love people to join the list and keep in touch with what's going on.
Great. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation and productivity? Maybe the same as question five before.
Yeah, I think it would be the same. I think marketing goes much further than, you know, I used to think marketing would be just a way that would teach me to kind of flog the stuff that I've got, but really marketing, it comes into the innovation and product development cycle very much, because I mean if you've got a product that nobody wants, it's going to be a much harder sell than a product that, you know, everybody wants, and a way that you deliver that's unique. So I think very much that comes down to learning and understanding marketing and where it fits into the product development cycle and innovation cycle, rather than just after you've got a product already created.
Mm. Yeah, that's good advice. And, you know, Seth Godin says that marketers change the people they serve. And if you haven't effected that change, then the marketing didn't work. And I sort of look at that and think, well, essentially anybody that's providing a product or service should be aiming to change the people they serve, right? In that sense, you know, marketing is such a core part of an entire business. It's not just the bit that gets your sales.
Very true.
Mm. All right. Now, you've given us some links where people can reach out and get in touch with you. So thanks for that. Now, finally, who would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast, and why?
I'd love to hear from any of the world-class marketers out there, you know, maybe Dean Jackson or Dan Kennedy. I'd love to hear from any of those. So, why not?
All right. Well, Dean and Dan will be reaching out to you, courtesy of Alan Dibb.
All right. Good.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your time today with us and your insights on the Innova Buzz podcast, Alan. You've been very generous, and you know, as I said, I really like the book. I like the framework you've laid out. I've learned a lot more about it today as well. And I wish you all the best for the future with all the things that you've got coming up in the next 6 to 12 months. And let's keep in touch.
Thank you, Jürgen. It was a genuine pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Alan as much as I enjoyed interviewing him. Alan has developed an exceptionally useful marketing framework that is applicable to all businesses. And he very clearly outlined that framework for us today and the reason behind each step. I certainly learned a lot and have lots of notes to action as a result of this interview. I highly recommend you get a copy of Alan's book, The One-Page Marketing Plan, and read it. It will likely change the way you think about marketing. All the great ideas and tips that Alan shared with us can be found at innovabiz.com.au/AlanDibb. That is A-L-L-A-N-D-I-B, all lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.com.au/AlanDibb. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Alan there. We'd love to hear about your biggest challenges in marketing in the comments section of the blog post. Alan suggested two world-class marketers, Dean Jackson and Dan Kennedy, for me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, both well-known in their field and prolific authors as well. So Dean and Dan, keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Alan Dibb. If you haven't already done so, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll never miss a future episode. Of course, we always welcome feedback and reviews to let us know how we're doing. If there's anything you'd like us to cover or questions you want answered on a future InnovaBuzz podcast or guests you'd like us to interview, please send those ideas to us as well. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, if you don't innovate, you stagnate. So think big, be adventurous, and keep innovating.